The faculty decided early on that we would meet every week and that we would meet at night because there was no time when everyone could meet during the day. So we met every Thursday evening. We had during that first year something like 29 faculty meetings. And most of those were at least 3 hours in length. I noticed, yes, 29 recorded meetings of the faculty. And in one of the items of business, it was decided that faculty meetings should endeavor to be over by 10 o'clock. But under certain circumstances, they would have to go beyond that time. Well, we met around a large card table in the library of the Coe Mansion. And in those early days, just after classes had begun, there was no electricity yet in the Coe Mansion anywhere. So we met by candlelight. So these night faculty meetings were all conducted by candlelight, candles on the table, on this long table around which the entire faculty could gather.
How'd you take notes?
Oh, by candlelight. Well, we had two morning meetings early on before classes opened, of course. But all the later meetings were held at night. Well, eventually we got electricity before winter came on, but I think it was 3 weeks or 4 weeks before we got electricity, probably.
That explains the large fireplaces.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it explains them, but what I remember, we sat, the table was arranged in front of one of those fireplaces, and there was a portrait watching over us, which was alleged to have been a Van Dyke, but I don't know whether everyone called it a Van Dyke, so it may well.
That was in the Great Hall, then?
No. It was in the room just before you come to the Great Hall. That's what we used as the library.
I see.
And, the Great Hall was, for our small numbers, was really too great. But we did use the Great Hall for other purposes. We used the Great Hall, for example, for our first convocation, which was held in November of that year. And President Carlson came to be present and to speak. He, I believe, was the second president of the university, with Al York being the first. And died within the past year, I believe.
Al York?
Yeah. I suppose people in the central administration told you a little bit about this moratorium that had been put on the development of new units within State University after the university was founded in 1948.
No, go ahead.
Well, New York was the last state to get a state university.
Right.
Although they had a number of
teachers'
colleges and specialized colleges and agricultural and technical institutes which were scattered around the state. Prior to 1948, each of these was a little fiefdom of its own. The legislator from the county where the college was housed was the one who submitted the budgetary request for that particular unit. And so there were all these separate budgetary bills coming in to the state legislature for years and years.
They didn't go through the Associate Commissioner for Higher Education?
Well, I don't know that to be true because this was before 1948 now. Before the university was founded.
Oh, yes.
And the legislators were returned to office on the basis of how much money they could extract for their own branch of a college in their own county. Well, that's clearly a bad system. And so the university actually dates from 1948, and it was resisted strongly by the private institutions in New York State. no way, given the most optimistic projections of every private institution in the state, of meeting these demands. They far exceeded what the private institutions could take care of. But
that was Owen DeYoung's commission.
I see. I probably knew it then, but I've long since forgotten it. So one of the trade-offs was that to the private institutions was that if we go along, because after all this had to be voted by a legislature which was made up wholly of graduates of private institutions.
Right.
And it still is.
Yeah.
And the trade-off was that there was an agreement, whether this was in writing or not, but there was an agreement there would be a 10-year moratorium on the opening of new units within state university. The last unit to be opened was at that time called Harper College at Binghamton, which grew out of a program which was operated during the Second World War.
Yes, it was an offshoot of Syracuse.
Okay. And so they were in existence, and so they were brought into the fold, as it were, in 1948. So when the state university was formed, brought together all the teachers' colleges, the specialized colleges at Cornell and Alfred and other places, and the Ags and Techs, and Harper College. And the medical centers, I guess, were included initially, downstate, upstate only, at that time. And that's what comprised the State University of New York in 1948. Now, the College of Long Island, then, when the moratorium was about to be up, it was, they began to put together planning committees for this new institution, partly as a result of a donation of land that Mr. Melville had made in Stony Brook.
You know why he made it?
I have ideas, but I'm not sure of the official reason.
Well, let's have them. But this is one of the...
I was told that that Mr. Melville, as a part of his restoration of Stony Brook as a colonial community, thought that a small liberal arts college near the town of Stony Brook would be an adjunct that would complement the restoration of Stony Brook, and which he thought would add an intellectual dimension to the village. And 400 acres is certainly enough to to build such a college on.
Right.
And that gift motivated the central administration to set up committees of consultants from over the country, not only to talk about programs, but to talk about buildings and so on. And there was a lot of preliminary planning being done in the middle 50s for the Stony Brook operation. And then, somewhere along the way, starting in 1957, they were then going to recruit the first members of a faculty group whose only function would be planning for the Stony Brook operation. That was the initial purpose. And when I came up for my interview, I was shown a lot of these early recommendations and even some building plans for Stony Brook that had been probably specifications that had been put together before then. Well, sometime before April of 1957, the Central Administration decided that they should not only have faculty who would serve as planners for the institution, but that it would be more useful in developing a curriculum if they had students to work with at the same time. Now, that was a late decision, and that was presumably what led to Leonard being selected as dean. He came down to Oyster Bay, moved into one wing of the mansion, and was given the task of recruiting a student body of indeterminate size, since no one, almost all college decisions had been made by that time. And where was one going to get a student body in May and June to open in September? Where was one going to get a faculty? And so that was a task that Len Olson undertook, and which he executed successfully. Students who made up the first class at Oyster Bay were not typical incoming college students by any means. They were in many cases older students. They were mature women with families. They were students who were undecided about whether or not they should go to college at all. And we ended up with a very heterogeneous and very interesting group of students, much more so, I believe, than if we had been working a whole year to recruit that first student body. Now, there were a lot of students taken in who found the college was not for them. The curriculum was rigorous, demanding, and 4 years later, only about, I think, 21 students graduated out of the 148 who entered in the...
Is that right?
Yes.
The first commencement
was very small. That's right. And the...
more tea. Oh, I'm all right.
I still have some tea here. Well, I think I'm not sure where I am here, but I was looking through the notes of the faculty meetings for the first year, and it's just amazing how many committees I found myself on. I mean, there weren't many people, and so everyone served on a lot of committees. And just to give you an example, well, I must make a little digression here just to show you that things haven't changed in 30 years. One of the notes I have from 30 years ago is keep record of total calls. So they had real financial concerns. I also have a note that the library was open Monday through Friday from 9 to 5, and Monday through Thursday, 7 to 9 at night. This was already at Oyster Bay. I might say that our library in August of 1957 consisted of a bookshelf not more than 6 feet long, all books that had been on loan from the New York State Library in Albany. They loaned us these books to start the library off. So it was not until later that we began to acquire our own books. Well, at any rate, faculty meeting, September 13th, 1957, everyone present. Point 4, degree requirements. Mr. Earth distributed copies of an outline of proposed degree requirements. After lengthy discussion, the question of degree requirements was postponed pending the acquisition of relevant factual material and the holding of discussions providing better basis for judgment. Now, that had been a committee made up of Ralph Bowen, who was a social scientist, myself, Harold Ziskind, and Leonard Gardner, that we had reported in, that had been set up earlier, and we reported in at the first faculty meeting.
Do you have any way of the names of the 14 faculty members?
Oh, sure. Given Dr. Marburger my only copy of the first catalog. Do you have a copy of that?
I don't think so.
You don't?
No.
He has what I call a virgin copy. It had never been used or opened, so he would have that in his file. Although I have a copy of the second catalog here, which includes all of the members of the first find. I did make for you, I just didn't have the resources to make more, but I made for you a summary of the faculty meetings of the first year. I think that was probably prepared by Harold Diskin, if I'm not mistaken.
I see.
And then here are the degree requirements for the class entering in September 1957. And here is the recommendation submitted to the dean April 1958 with an addendum from Ralph Bowen about what the required courses would be. So it took us, we worked most of the year getting the requirements together. Here's the freshman class of the fall of 1958 and what their expressions of interest are.
I see. Well, you had 8,000 times.
I wonder if we do better than that even now.
I don't know.
I thought that was pretty good at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's see. I wanted to talk a little bit about the faculty meetings of that first year.
Okay.
There were two kinds of faculty meetings. One kind of meeting was held to take care of what I would call academic business. Matters of probation, academic standards that had to be met, and such things as that. Well, here I have it in the first meeting. Mr. Olson said there would be two types of faculty meetings. One, concerned with administrative problems relevant to the total program. Two, concerned with intellectual discussions, which would be reflected in administrative decisions. I don't think that reads correctly, but nevertheless, we held every other meeting, more or less, would be devoted to the reading of texts and the discussion by all members of the faculty. And people would prepare position papers on these various documents. They would use them as models to see what a course should actually try to do with particular subject matter. Because the initial problem that we had was to, if you can imagine, here is a group of 14 faculty with a tremendous opportunity, a blank slate, no curriculum. The opportunity was unique because how often can you sit down and say, now, if we could do anything we wanted to in the development of a college curriculum, what would we do? And we took nothing for granted. Every proposal was thoroughly examined and discussed in the light of the varying experiences of the members of the faculty who came that first year and deliberated on at great length. Nothing was assumed. And the problem is never as great in the area of specialization. It's never as great a problem to know what a biology major should include in his or her program as what should the common educational experience be that all students, biologists, chemists, physicists, mathematics, humanists, social scientists have. everyone agreed, I believe, that the way to develop these skills was not to try to encompass large amounts of factual information, but rather to focus upon a limited number of excellent texts, which would then be discussed thoroughly in class. And this was a principle that was followed in all of the disciplinary areas. And although, of course, it was implemented in different ways in the different disciplines. At any rate, we also used some secondary sources, and we wanted to find out what the experience of other institutions had been. And the first book that we all read was the Harvard Report, which I think must have come out around 46 or 47. Anyhow, it's called
General Education
and Free Society.
Yeah.
And so we were all assigned to read the first four chapters in that, and that provided the discussion for our faculty meeting. Something that would absolutely be astounding in faculty meetings today, wouldn't it?
Right.
Then we went on and looked at the Columbia program, a college program in action and reconstruction in the liberal arts. So we viewed those two.
Who wrote that, Dean? Somebody.
I don't have the authors here anymore, but...
Right.
But we, at the end of our year in these various programs, when I was a Carnegie intern in general education at Chicago, we all converged upon Columbia. That's right. It was Columbia, Chicago, and Harvard that participated in this program, this Carnegie Grant.
Yeah.
And we all met for about 2 days or 3 days at Harriman House, which is, as you know where it is, north on the Hudson.
Yeah.
And
that was a nice place to meet.
Oh, marvelous. Just a marvelous place. I think that's why I first met Francis Bond, as a matter of fact. I think he had come from Harvard.
I see.
I come from Scotland. There were people who were from. There were three interns at each institution, if I remember. So it was not a large program. Let me tell you some of the other things we looked into. We looked into Joseph Schwab's The Nature of Scientific Knowledge as Related to Liberal Education. Joe Schwab was a faculty member at Chicago. I didn't know him then, but I came to know him very well later on when I worked with the Biological Science of Curriculum Study. And he was sort of the father figure who gave us a philosophical basis for what we were doing and trying to assist in secondary education.
Time.